You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a far ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds passed right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Welcome to The Spear, the story of the combat experience brought to you by the Modern War Institute at West Point. I am your host, Dr. Charles Faint, and today's guest is Major Ryan Crane. Ryan was commissioned into the U.S. Army through the ROTC program at Toledo University, and he also earned an MBA at the University of Michigan. He served in the 82nd Airborne Division, the 75th Ranger Regiment, and the 1st Infantry Division, and is now assigned to West Point's Simon Center for the Professional Military Ethic. Today we are discussing the leadership lessons learned from an emergency deployment Ryan and his Rangers conducted in 2014 that involved movement from a training area in California back to their home station in Savannah, Georgia, and then almost directly into combat in Afghanistan. Well, really pleased to have you here with us today. You've got a fantastic story about your emergency deployment that we'll get into in a few minutes. But first, I think we'd like to start with your background. Can you tell us a little bit how you came into the Army and some things you did before this mission?
Yeah. So grew up in the suburbs of Detroit, a city called Westland, like 30 minutes outside. I guess it all started like going into high school. I was in JROTC, but I joined it on a whim. Parents not military. Grandparents served just a little bit, like one grandfather served a little bit, so not like a military family at all. And my senior ROTC instructor in high school was like, hey, you could do this thing. This is your route to college. I got a scholarship with the University of Toledo, ROTC, and I went to ROTC there. I didn't really know what to do. I told my parents I was going to be an engineer in the Army, and that was like blue-collar parents were like, son's going to be an engineer. This was like 2007, so this was right around the surge, and understandably, parents kind of worried about that and said I was going to be an engineer, and they were kind of like, okay, you're an engineer, you know. And then as I went through the years at ROTC, I was studying engineering too. I just was like, do I want to be an engineer? I'm not sure. And I had some amazing cadre, like that mentorship there. They kind of just, every now and then, they would just kind of like wink and be like, you need to do something, you need to push yourself a little bit. You need to do something more. And things are going to be hard and people are going to be in danger. Somebody that is kind of good at this thing. And I kind of, by that time I was like, hey, I think I'm decent at this Army thing. It should probably be somebody good leading those people that are going to be in the most dangerous situation. So I decided to be an infantry officer. That's what I put forth. And, you know, I got my first request. Also was like, what's the best place I could go to? And that was the 82nd. So I signed up for that. And I was fortunate enough to be high enough on the OML to get it. So commissioned in 2012, did kind of the typical lieutenant things. I served in 2505 for about 15 months in a platoon. I went right into a platoon, had an awesome platoon. Sergeant First Class Herzog was my platoon sergeant. We were on the Global Response Force the whole time. So we were just training nonstop, but we were waiting for the balloon to go up, waiting for, you know, the call. And, you know, my NCOs would tell me like, for it, waiting for the big thing to pop off. And actually, funny enough, we were at JROTC. We had just finished our live fires. And this was the time in which Bashar al-Assad dropped the first chemical weapon. And I remember the command teams had a big, big huddle. And it was kind of serious. You know, we're all looking at our phones. This was also the time when President Obama was like, this is the red line. The red line was crossed. Big command meeting, brigade commander, battalion commander, primary staff, company commander. So platoon leader on down is kind of just like, what's going on? What's going on? And I remember my company commander getting back. He brought us into the battalion area and like outrolled on the map was Aleppo. And we're like, wow. Okay, this is it. Turns out it wasn't it. And that's when I was like, I think I need to go do something more. I need to go seek out a way to kind of fulfill that.
So I'm curious about what the dynamic was with that, and maybe not just with him, but in general. When you started telling people that you wanted to leave the 82nd, yeah. which is his own little mafia in the Army for good reasons, and you were going to go to the Range Regiment, was there any sense of this is a betrayal or you think you're better than us or anything like that?
My company commander was really cool with it. Not Range Regiment background. My battalion commander was really cool with it, but he was close hold about it.
Mm.
And I think he did publicly say only one person from this battalion is going to go.
Mm.
And I remember my fellow lieutenants were all heavy hitters. It was a crazy group of lieutenants. They were all heavy hitters.
Mm-hmm.
Reflecting on those lieutenants, all of them, many of them would have been qualified to go. I remember there was a lieutenant that later on was like, he was like, Ryan, do you want to go? He was like, you're taking this from me.
Oh.
And I was like, dude. And so there was the friction there.
Sure.
With only one person gets to go, was supportive, but at the same time, he was like, I'm not letting everybody out. And then, honestly, I think like four other lieutenants ended up going SF.
Yeah.
So that shows you the cohort that I was among. He only said one could go, and then the rest went the way that you don't need the battalion commander signature.
Very interesting, because having never served in the Range Regiment or the 82nd Airborne Division, it seems like that would be a natural feeder, because the 82nd tends to attract people who are high performers
yeah.
that want to be in elite units. Everything that you're describing, yeah. they're infantry and airborne qualified. I like to think if I were a battalion commander, I'd see it as a sign of prestige yeah. that my lieutenants are fleeting up to this other organization.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a weird dynamic, because the regiment, and I think it's still this way, is that it needs, you know, the assigned 4187, whereas
right.
SF doesn't.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's a weird dynamic where your battalion commander presumably has to give up one of their best to go. And I remember there was only one other guy from my brigade, my buddy who's out now, Zach Champa. So out of my 82nd brigade, only two LTs
wow.
went to the Ranger. The 4187 has to go all the way up to the brigade as well.
Okay.
There is this kind of like this friction, this close hold about who gets to go, who should they go, are they worthy to go, type thing. And that is just to rasp.
Right.
I was a scout PL for about 7 months. He made me the scout PL pretty much right after that conversation. Left my first platoon after about 14 months. Became the scout PL. In the 7 months after that, I was a scout PL, which was a great experience. A lot of training, a lot of freedom, because my company commander moved over from the rifle platoon to my HHC.
Nice.
So he just was like, I know you can do well. So I had a lot of freedom in that time. I was like doing the packet, doing the physicals, getting ready, you know, getting my first OER signed, all that stuff that's required, interfacing with the Ranger Regiment S1, figuring out where I wanted to go. And at that time, that was before AIM or the marketplace or anything like that. So I was just like, which place seems cool? First bat seems pretty cool. I like the beach. Email first bat, you know, and they emailed me right back. Hey, send this packet.
So nice.
That was the time. And so during that time, you know, I was closing in on 20 something months of PL time, and then got my RAS date, and then it ended up getting moved back, I think twice.
Hmm.
And so in the queue to go to RAST for like 7 months. So I was like wow. a known loss.
Yeah.
Not ostracized, but again, like there's some friction between me and the other PLs a little bit. He's going, he's a known loss. We got to get the backup. You know, who's the next scout PL? And then, you know, then I win. And I think that's right when they did announce that they were going to deploy to Iraq too. That might have been some of the thought process in, okay, the scout platoon is not going because they have a PL
that makes sense
in transition or something like that. And my soldiers were heavy hitters. I think it was more like the battalion commander just wanted line companies that were more regimented and I guess had a more stabilized leadership structure going TDY.
That makes a lot of sense too. And I know that if you're smart as a commander, you're going to leave a good officer and team behind to run the rear debt.
Yeah.
I remember my dad telling me stories about Desert Storm. Of course, there were no wars and everyone was falling over each other to go. And he left a good officer back to run his rear debt, which of course broke that guy's heart. But other commanders didn't. They left low performers back and everything kind of fell apart, which affects forward too. So yeah. I can see that the logic as well.
There was one captain that got to RAS. One captain got left back. It was my company commander, HHC. Your HHC is typically your best performer. He gets left back. And then there was like three or four of the lieutenants, and they were great. So I think some of them ended up going SF too. So maybe they were in transition. And, you know, they were like, you know, we got left behind.
Yeah.
They're in Iraq.
Yep.
You know, they were trying to figure out what they were going to do, too. So everybody was kind of vying for to go get theirs. But
right.
To go serve. And some people got left behind. Some people were trying to figure out other options. And here I was in this dilemma. My platoon had been keyed up to stay behind. My battalion was about to go forward to Iraq. I'm going TDY to RAS. And if I don't pass, if I don't get selected, then I'm going to be back here being a rear D
right.
commander or something like that.
Well, those are pretty high stakes. And yeah. You're coming back not only having failed, which to me isn't necessarily a dishonorable thing or anything, because most people can't get in the range right in the first place, but yeah. You're coming back to the unit that everyone knows that you didn't get the thing that you left the unit
yeah.
for.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was definitely high stakes. I think I was more concerned in the now. I was more like, maybe it's just reflectively me saying this, but I think it was the case where, like, I wanted to go more than I didn't want to fail.
Right.
Which is a good right. mindset to have. And maybe I've not had that mindset forever. But I think that was one of the times in which Ranger School would have been different. Ranger School, I probably didn't want to fail more than I wanted to pass. But RASP, I wanted to pass and wanted to get selected more than I didn't want to fail. I think I was like, hey, people don't get selected. I could not be the right case. Went to RASP, great experience there. Incredible cohort of people that I was with. Some of them I still talk to, still buddies with. They invite more infantry lieutenant than they have room for. And the other MOSs, I think, are not the same because there's a higher, you know, there's a higher demand, there's lower supply.
Right.
So you kind of know, okay, not all of us are going to get selected. I remember going through the board and it's described as kind of a murder board. And they're talking about your performance and they just pick out your weaknesses. I remember them saying, but you're kind of slow on the 5 mile. I think I ran like a 32 or a 33,
oh my.
Which was, I guess, happened to be the bottom of kind of the bottom half.
Wow.
Of run.
Okay.
It's got some fast lieutenants. Right. 33 was slow for the Ranger lieutenants at the time.
Okay.
And then, but I ran like a 208 ruck or something like that, a low 2 ruck. They're like, but you can ruck. So I guess you're okay. And I was like, I thought 208 was pretty good. I think I came in like second or third. But, you know, they go through everything. And I remember I got a split decision. Yes. There's a board of, I think it's 5.
Okay.
The lowest, you can only get 1 no. And I got 1 no. And then they went down the board. I remember them going down the board and it's all the battalion leadership and some of the regimental leadership. They went down from my right, the board's left. Yes. Yes. The middle officer said no.
Were you kind of sweating it the rest of the time?
Yeah.
That was your 1 no go?
Yeah. He said no. And he listed off some things. He was like, you weren't good here. I think gave some canned answers here.
So do you think that was a legit no or is it no? So you didn't get a big head?
I don't know. I mean, they know you. It sometimes feels like they know you better than you. They have the psychologist sitting there. They have your Wunderlich score.
Yeah.
They have your IQ score. Yeah. They have your questionnaire. So psychologist is whispering in their ear. They're like, this guy's, you know, he's not confident about this or he's a little bit cocky. And they're like, pick at that. And they're also, they have their computers in front of them. They're messaging each other. Say that more. Talk about his peers. Talk about his runtime. Talk about how he came in a little slow on land nav.
Wow.
Talk about his LRC lane. They're finding the weakness. And it's an amazing process because if you crack in a board because somebody poked at your runtime or questioned your leadership on a obstacle course lane, you're going to crack in combat.
Totally. Yeah.
And so I get that fully. Embrace that, understood. And thankfully, I understood that. I was like, they're going to find the chinks in the armor and they're going to pry them apart with their vast experience and knowledge.
So for our listeners who might not be familiar with RASP, that's the Ranger Assessment Selection Program. Yeah. So you're going through RASP as an infantry officer for an infantry position yeah. in the Ranger Regiment.
Yeah.
Are there support folks in there with you? Are they doing the same things yes. you're doing?
Yeah. So it's RASP 2 is E7 and above.
Okay.
And so the cohort's about 40 people.
Mm.
It was about 10 infantry lieutenants, 3 or 4 infantry captains and above.
Okay.
And then the rest was a smattering of a military intel, fire. So there was a couple technical guys. I think we had a chaplain.
Mm.
The low density of those, they could make up the latter half of the class. A couple of E7s, obviously, a couple of infantry E7s. And then, like I said, there was intel NCOs, fires NCOs, things like that, signal officers, you know.
Wow. So they're all doing the same things, you held to the same standards. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the standards are relatively doable. Same thing at Ranger School. Oh, you have to do X amount of push-ups, X amount of sit-ups, 5 mile in 40 minutes. Nobody came close to 40. You know, I ran a 33 and they're like, you're slow. 12 mile ruck in 3 hours. You know, nobody is going to the standard, but they're getting, everybody's getting ranked and assessed.
So what is that like for the dynamics of the group? An infantry battalion, for example, there can be a very big difference in prestige and the way people are treated between the infantry guys and the support MOSs. So I'm imagining it might be a little different in the Ranger Regiment where everyone had to go through the same thing to get there. Yeah. Was that your experience?
Yeah, I mean, some of these support people are performing at the same or better caliber than you, and you've never seen a signal officer as tough as this signal officer.
The chaplain passing you on a 5 mile run.
Yeah, well, yeah. Ironically, the chaplain was like a marathon there. We were going to do a 5 mile on a Thursday morning. On a Wednesday morning, he came in the barracks. He was like, who wants to go do a little shakeout run? I'm going to go about 4 miles. So I was like, man, we're running 5 miles tomorrow morning. You're gonna shake it out with four? I was like, no, Chappie, count me out. I'm going to stretch.
Right, right.
But yeah, so everybody there is a crazy high performer. There is definitely, though, an expectation that the combat arms perform a little bit better. And we were obviously getting compared to each other.
Yes.
And their MOSs were getting, in some ways, compared to the standard because not as many signal officers at one.
For sure.
Rangers.
Right.
And so if they could pass the standard and they were tough, then the Ranger Regiment needed them. Whereas the infantry officers, hey, you need us more than we need you.
Yeah.
And so we're going to take only 2/3 of you, you know, only a couple of you.
Yeah.
And so we're going down the board. Now, remember, the last person on the board that was going to be the deciding factor was the battalion sergeant major of my battalion, Sergeant Major Bishop, great sergeant major that I had. He says, one of the best yeses I've ever given. And I was like, I don't care what anybody else said. My sergeant major said one of the best yeses that I've ever given. Awesome. I still remember, you know, I guess 8 years ago, 7 years ago.
Did he look down at the guy in the middle when he said it? Best yes I've given.
No, I mean, he just laid it out. If anybody's opinion mattered, he was the only guy from 175. I'm going to work for that guy. Good to go.
Did they tell you right then which battalion you're going to go to?
It was 175. I was already slated for 175.
Okay.
So it's changed now. They kind of like throw you around.
Yeah.
But at that point in time, they like hedged you towards what battalion based on slotting and stuff like
so
that.
So you were either going to first bat or you weren't going to the regiment.
I think they've probably done this and it was part of where they'd be like, hey, what if we offer you 375? Something changed. Yeah, I would have said yes.
Yeah.
But at that point, I had been interacting with the 175 team for a long time. They had said yes to me. So this sergeant major had seen my packet. And then I went in there saying, hey, I'm going to 175. And I went into that board knowing who the leadership was and seeing my sergeant major for the first time. He obviously grilled me on questions, too. But his final thing is, it's kind of funny because, like, aside from the guy that said no, and he professionally said no, and he called out all my weakness and stuff like that, everybody else is like, welcome. And he was like, one of the best yeses. Happy to have you serve.
Nice. Amazing.
Yeah. And I remember walking out into the area, like kind of the waiting area. And I called my girlfriend, now wife, and I ring the phone. She picks up. She goes, hello? Hello, Ryan. And I'm like, hey. And she goes, yeah.
What do you mean? Hey. What's yeah.
What's going on? She said, did you make it? Because she knew the timing and like going in the board, right? And I was like, yeah, I did. She was like, you sound upset. And I was like, the board was pretty tough. And she said, are you happy? I was like, yeah, I think so. I think I'm happy. But yeah, they tore into you a little bit. But I'm happy. I'm excited. So I had to like shake off the assassination attempt.
Right, right.
And then I went into a better frame of mind going, okay, now we're going. In 3 weeks, we're PCO.
Oh, that quickly.
Yeah,
wow.
I think it was 3 or 4 weeks. And like I said, I was with my girlfriend, longtime girlfriend at the time, and you leave the RAS board and you walk over to the regimental S1 and S4 shop and they start processing your PCS. And it's like you left with orders in hand to be there in 30 days. And, you know, this was a time when Ranger Regiment had been deployed for 20 straight years in the global war on terror. And this was in 2015. In which there was constantly a battalion overseas.
Right.
And so there was not time to chill out and time to figure out, hey, do you want to second guess it? There was none of that. It's like, we need you. We're deploying.
Pack your stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. You wanted to be here. Let's go. And I was about that. So
wow.
I was like, yeah, can I report early? Like, let me, like, I'll figure everything out on the backside. And my girlfriend, now wife, was amazing with helping me all the stuff on the backside too. But I was like, this is it.
Wow.
I'm coming back and packing my stuff immediately and we're going.
Your experience with the Ranger Regiment sounds a lot like mine with the 160th. And I went over 160th, very similar to what you described. On my board, I didn't think I did well at all. And I probably did. They certainly said I didn't. And they were like, well, we don't know if we want you. You need to go out, sit there while we deliberate. So I went out there and I was thinking about it, rethinking my life decisions. 2 hours went by. And I was sitting there thinking, if it took them this long to argue about it, that means there's like one dude that wants me and everybody else doesn't.
Yeah.
So I had enough time to process that I wasn't going the 160. I was like, okay, I'm okay with this. We went in there, and then the president of the board, who's one of the battalion commanders in 160th, said, Captain Fain, after long deliberation, we've decided to send you back to 5th Group. And I was still crushed, but I had time to process it, and I knew it was coming. So I was like, all right, sir, thank you. I appreciate your time. I'll try again next year. He's like, you didn't let me finish, Captain. We're sending you back to 5th Group to pack your shit to come over to 160th. And what happened is, as soon as I left the room, they looked at each other like, yeah, he's good. Let's go to lunch. So they went to lunch and then came back and brought me back in. That's why I was waiting for so long. So.
Oh my God.
Little bit of mind games on that. All right. So now you're at the regiment.
Yeah.
So what's life like for you and leading up to this event that we're going to talk about?
Yeah. So I reported, and at 175, you kind of report in through third ID. And so you're kind of an oddball. You're wearing your tambourine, which you still, there's imposter syndrome here. You know, it's like,
because you don't feel like you're a ranger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you're wearing the scroll on your left. You're wearing the tambourine, and I wore a maroon beret, but I'm like, this is you look different than all the dog face soldiers. And you're checking in, and then you report to 175, and you kind of reported there, and you kind of just report up to the battalion headshed, and they're like, you know, new crop of lieutenants, where do we need extra work? And I actually reported to the S1 shop, fresh lieutenant. And it's the way the Ranger Regiment works is like the NCOs handle the real S1 work, and the battalion S1, a captain. At the time, Captain Marion was pretty much just an extra S3 officer. He's like planning a live fire as the S1. and so I help him plan a live fire.
Sure.
But in the background, we have, you know, a deployment coming up and how we're going to go deploy. And we're not going forward to be S1s. We're going to integrate with the Joint Task Force forward.
Nice.
So it was about 2 months, planned a live battalion live fire, kind of just like prove that I could think that I could, you know, execute tasks, help run a range, you know, be the support for the battalion while I was up on staff, prove that eventually I could take a platoon, deployed forward and was a targeting officer to the task force in Afghanistan, was in the JOC and targeting. And so was on a targeting team that allocated strike assets to targets. And I kind of figured out that entire process, how the entire task force apparatus decides that there is a bad guy at this location. How do we find out where they're at? I was in the teams that was essentially the go-between between the deep intel teams, include all the agencies, everybody working in the deep intel apparatus that were essentially finding these people, confirming the intel. And I was the team that turned the deep intelligence into strikeable intelligence.
Got
essentially.
It.
So the team below me was obviously the strike team. They controlled the assets overhead and actually prosecuted the technical aspect of doing a strike. But I was the one on a team that was understanding these people, filtering between the deep intelligence and saying, okay, this is where we're going to put the asset at this time, at this location. And so that was my first deployment on staff.
Well, that sounds like you're jumping in with both feet. That sounds like a pretty sophisticated operation with a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, it was great. And you could see the results of your labor. You see all of your work come to fruition, and then you think about all the work of the people that have been working on this a long time, and then you think about, like, we're actually executing the will of what our country is trying to do. We're taking bad people off the map.
Right.
And you watch it play out, and then you gather intel. Okay, hey, this person got struck. You hear the chatter on the intel, and you're like, okay, we did this.
We did that, yeah.
The work. And so that was like, you know, when I was 82nd PL, I'm like at the rifle range, at the live fire. My SAW gunner improved his qualification score. My staff sergeant upped his PT score. Like, this is going to pay off. It will. I know it will. We're going to train hard. We're going to do this. And then that was kind of the first time when I see, like, okay, this amazing group of people that we have trained and has gotten better over time. Now we're all collectively together. We're actually doing our job. And I can see, like, on the screen in front of me, the work the nights that I put in, the software, all of the updates and all the trackers that I did, that a bad person is off the map.
Yep.
And it was because of my staff
work. It's got to be super rewarding to see that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's weird reflectively thinking, you know, it's rewarding to take somebody off the map like that. But there's such an apparatus behind it. You know about how bad they are. What makes it is that when we execute, everybody is happy because we know we've all done our job to the nth degree and that person is gone. And Americans are going to be better off.
I've seen in the past, and we've experienced that sometimes you don't hit a guy because it's actually working better for you. Because the dude's an idiot and always on his phone or he's making bad tactical decisions. Have you seen any of that as well?
Yeah, we had some targets that you pick up through intel that they are known associates. You know, that first off, that's like kind of how you find half of them is that, hey, this same guy is around this guy. Is he just a crony or is he also a bad guy himself? You know, again, you use the software, you use the SIGINT, the GON, all of our intelligence apparatus, and you're like, wait a sec, guy B is traveling between guy A and guy C. We know C is bad. We know A is bad. Who's this B guy? Oh, he's bad himself because he's going to guy D, guy E, guy F. Connect all these dots, and there's this web of who you want to strike and when you want to strike them. And then, again, there's all these different types of intelligence, SIGINT. There's human.
Right.
People telling us, no, not yet. Wait.
Right.
There's a meeting. Let's let the meeting occur. Let's hear about the chatter after the meeting. What are they planning? Don't strike yet because we don't know where his hideout is. We don't know where his actual home is or where this is where he lives with his family, but we don't know where his hard drives are, where all his data is, where the money is by chance that he's filtering. And this was also a time on my first deployment that I ended up executing on the second deployment where we started seeing Islamic State.
Mm.
In Afghanistan, we started seeing them pop up in difference to Taliban or Al Qaeda, because we could tell the difference between them based on the intelligence. We knew different cells, different factions, what Taliban was doing, and they were low priority. They were, you know, at this point in time, that was not our mission as counterterrorism, really. We knew Al Qaeda; they were the long-standing group there, and they had a long history of financing and conducting terror attacks across the Middle East and even planning terror attacks in Europe and in Asia and America, obviously. But this was also the time we started seeing Islamic State pop up. And it was evident because they were very vocal and their crimes against the people were very heinous.
Mm.
And so there was a distinct difference in what they were doing and who they were. And they were, like I said, extremely heinous in the crimes they were committing against the local people. And they were very brazen at that point in time in Afghanistan, because they were kind of just popping up and trying to take charge, even from the Qaeda that was in the area at the time.
Well, so you got bad guys fighting each other then.
Yeah. And they had areas in which they started to control. And Al Qaeda at the time was kind of the OGs. They had smaller networks and cells. They were a little bit more hiding. They were a little bit more sophisticated. They were the guys that had multiple cell phones. They were the guys that had multiple houses, multiple places to go. They knew how to shake us, knew how to get away from our targeting efforts. Whereas whether the Islamic State at the time was not as sophisticated or whether they just didn't care because they were so radicalized, they were very out in the open and very brazen about, you know, what they were doing. Also, at this time is when our targeting started dramatically increasing in Iraq. And so we started seeing the connections, you know, internationally between the cells communicating the Islamic State in Afghanistan, the Islamic State in Iraq, seeing intelligence pointing to Pakistan, you know, everywhere Islamic State is popping up, and they were keenly different than Al Qaeda at the time. Just at the tail end of 15, and like I said, our team, when we handed off, regiment hands off, you know, the battalions rotate through.
Mm-hmm.
We handed off to the next battalion coming through. And there was a cell that was small in Iraq at the time because they weren't really doing raids in Iraq like we were in Afghanistan.
Okay.
Everything started ramping up because the Islamic State started ramping up. We started putting more people in Syria and Iraq the next deployment. And we rotated out, left Afghanistan, went back. And then that's when I got my platoon.
Nice.
So I guess I proved that I was capable enough to take a platoon in 175.
Despite your slow runtime.
My mediocre runtime, but just agreeable enough ruck time.
Yes. Yeah. All right.
So I took a platoon in 175 in the early months, like pretty much like Christmas time, actually, 2015, early months, January 2016. Took a platoon, you know, so this is my third platoon, having a rifle PL, a scout PL, and now taking a ranger platoon. And this was the platoon that was on the deployment with me. So they had gone out, they had just came back, all those soldiers had deployed, all those soldiers had, you know, CIBs, CABs, like every NCO, everybody was combat experience. Mm-hmm. So it didn't matter which, but this was the unit that was fresh. So even the privates, like even the PV2s had a CIB and they were ready. I had just put on my scroll on my right side. So I was deployed because when I came to the battalion, I was slick sleeve on the right side. Right. But then when we got to Afghanistan, you know, deployed, put on the patch. And mind you, I know I see these, the patching ceremonies has been a thing. There was none of that. We got to Afghanistan and there was no ceremony. There was no nothing. We didn't wear patches anyways, but we got to Afghanistan. We came back home. There wasn't like a ceremony to like put your new patch on. Obviously, a lot of the junior officers and some of the junior soldiers, it was their first deployment. So when they returned to actually put on patches, they put their patches on their left. And they put for the first time the patch on the right. For the junior officers, it wasn't like a thing. It was like, go to the PX. Where's the 175 scroll? Now I got two.
Right,
you
know, right.
You weren't, here's the thing, you weren't special because now you're amongst everybody else.
Right.
That's deployed umpteenth times. You know, so it was a real humbling experience, something that I was, you know, had been seeking for 4 years in JRTC, 4 years in RTC. That was like, I'm going to deploy. I want to do this. You know, 2 years in the 82nd. Oh, no, I'm going to miss my shot in the 82nd. Oh, no, we didn't go to Syria. Oh, no, my battalion's going to deploy to Iraq and they're going to leave me behind. I'm now in the Ranger Regiment. I passed RASP. I came all this way. I actually did the work on the task force staff. Happy to come back from deployment and having done something good and taken bad people off the map. And I put on the scroll and I was like, okay, all right. Anything changed? Am I taller? No, I'm not taller. Am I stronger? Fat? Nope, I'm the same. Just a couple ounces of cloth on the side. And it was like, okay, here we are. Should have been something grander, but it's not. Okay, let's get back to work. Right now I have a platoon.
Yeah.
And so took the platoon in the early months, and we went through the full train-up because they were the ones on the deployment cycle. So we restarted it. We got a fresh crop of new Ranger privates, individual marksmanship, all the way up. My first platoon sergeant is a legend in the special operations community. Just call him Sergeant S. He's still in it right now. He was amazing. You hear sometimes like scary stories about those NCOs, right? And this guy, again, he was a legend. My battalion commander called him a graybeard. He called other NCOs silverbacks, graybeard. You know, they were the warrior tribe.
Yeah.
And here's a C-7, probably got 10 deployments under his belt.
Wow.
And he takes LT Crane in. He's like, yeah, sir, let's work together. Let's make it happen. You know, hey, you want to talk to the soldiers? Let's talk to the soldiers. Lieutenants are most scared about is counseling NCO. How am I going to counsel the C-7 who has spent more time in the GWAT than I have in the Army? And, you know, we're at a flat range and I'm like, hey, sir, can we do a counseling? Right. He's like, yeah, sit down. You know, I tell him, hey, this is how I see us working together. This is my strengths, my weaknesses. Tell him my weaknesses. I ask about his, you know, what he likes to do and where I think I need help. And then he gives advice where he thinks he can help me. He tells me what he's not good at and what he wants an officer to do. And he had probably gone through, I was probably his 8th PL or something like that, from private all the way up. He had gone through and met many lieutenants. He'd come to the conclusion that, hey, we're going to get these lieutenants right. We're going to train them up. He's the platoon leader. I'm going to support him. And that was amazing. And it's not always what happened with NCOs, especially in the Ranger Regiment, with their platoon leaders.
I can imagine.
Yeah, I know some platoon leaders have poor experiences with their NCOs. Mm. And it's understandable if a platoon leader comes in the wrong way, and I can't imagine how you could, but you come in the wrong way and you don't establish a good relationship with your platoon sergeant, they have essentially full authority to put you in the corner.
All right.
If you're going to be a detriment to the platoon as a lieutenant, like here's the facts. Like, you don't need the platoon leader in the Ranger Regiment. We can make do without the platoon leader. Also, like if we do need a platoon leader, we can get one here in, you know, 3 months.
Right.
Just make it happen.
Right.
Thankfully, Sergeant S was just awesome, and he helped me along. He helped me be the platoon leader. Like he You know, I gave the op orders. I gave guidance. I was a mentorship to some of the squad leaders. He helped me throughout the whole process.
So you mentioned that a Ranger platoon doesn't need a PL because it's so high performance, et cetera. Do you think your platoon sergeant specifically and the other platoon sergeants in the Ranger Regiment thought their platoon was better off with a PL under most circumstances?
I think as a PL in the Ranger Regiment, you have to meet such a high threshold to be value add, because the role in which you fill in the platoon is a vital role. It's very particular where you fit in the platoon, but it's also a very vulnerable role to lead that formation in the role. The platoon leader is the up and out of in the Ranger Regiment. You are controlling a lot of assets. You are managing the fight. You have your fingers in a lot of things, but you are not necessarily actioning them.
Okay.
You're managing them all.
Okay.
All the assets, including assets that are above you at the strategic level. You're managing all those things. And so if you're not capable of doing all of that, then you're mismanaging strategic assets and you're a detriment.
Mm.
And so you have to be at such a high threshold to be value add that if you're not at that threshold, you're actually, if you don't know how to control these assets, if you don't know how to control and synchronize the squads with the fires, with the signal efforts, with the air assets, if you don't know how to synchronize that whole fight and tell people, okay, stop, go, this is coming in, wait 30 seconds, okay, initiate here. If you can't do all that and you're on the mic, you're at the helm, if you do that wrong, people are in danger. Mm. You're messing things up. Fires are coming in while people are initiating things. Like, get that person off the mic. Get them out of the platoon. So you have to be at such a threshold that, you know, you're value added. And if you're anything below that, you're actually a detractor. Whereas maybe a private or a sergeant, hey, you're just an extra body. Maybe you're not good, but we need somebody to pull security.
Right.
You know? And you'll learn, right? Ranger privates, they learn. They go on their first deployments. Hey, pull security that way. Hey, carry the ammo. Hey, come with me to the MG position. They learn. They're not value detracted at all. Even if they're learning and they're young and they're on their first deployment, maybe they mess up here and there. PL, there is no leeway to learn necessarily. You're going to make mistakes, but if you make them too often, too many times in the wrong places, the mistakes that you can make as a Ranger platoon leader are critical. So I think, you know, Sergeant S did a great job of getting me to the right place where I think I was value add as a PL there.
Nice.
And obviously that benefited him because he could have been doing all the things that a platoon sergeant does and doing all the things that PL, he could have done it. But guess what? He wanted to do the things that a platoon sergeant does really good.
Right.
So, hey, PL, you control these things. I control these things. You know, you could be the LeBron James to my Dwayne Wade. I don't want to do it all. So let me just do my thing really good, and I'll help you do your thing really good.
I think that's an excellent analogy. And I think that leads well into the event we're going to discuss about this emergency deployment.
Yeah.
So could you give us some background on that and then go ahead and tell the story?
Yeah. So I went through my platoon. Right. And at the end of this long training cycle, our company was slated to not deploy.
Okay.
So the battalion was deploying every company at that time except one. And they were going to go do a training mission. And because the company I was in had just came back from being the strike force company, they were understandably slated to not be strike force company. So, right. So I'm sitting here like, okay, what am I going to do? At the end of my PL time, the battalion is picking who's going to be company XOs, right? So my PL time is done after about 8 months. And they're like, you're going to be the same company XO that you're in. And on one hand, I'm like, I love this company. I love the leaders here. It's created a great environment here. I love all the soldiers. Company commander's good. First sergeant's good. I'm glad I get to stay. On the other hand, I'm like, okay, I'm slated to go to be with the company that didn't deploy. And also, you know, again, here we are back in this mindset. I had deployed, but I had not stepped on ground.
And right.
I had not fought the fight. I'm an infantry officer. I had done the work I wanted to do on my first deployment, but I had not, my boots were clean.
So maybe you'd been to war, but not to combat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wanting more. Okay. So I'm the CECO XO and I'm like happy. And we're slated to go to the Marine Corps Mountain Warfare Training Center.
Okay.
So Amazing training center run by the Marine Corps. It looks just like Northeast Afghanistan. I don't know how this was a secret to me. I don't know why this place is not used more. Maybe it is by the Marine Corps, but like the Army needs to be going there. It was a great, great environment. We deploy out to there, you know, TDY fashion. As the company XO, the outgoing XO and I kind of coordinate a lot of the logistics, getting all of our arms there, getting all of our equipment, all of our assets. So we're sending vehicles out there. We're sending all of our weapons. We're sending ammunition out there through this intricate logistics process. I'm the company XO now, so I got to figure this stuff out, right? How are we getting, you know, all our weapons there? They're going to be line hauled. How are we taking ammo there, which is a whole other debacle. Taking ammo across the country from Savannah, Georgia to California is not an easy task. And then, you know, we're taking Humvees there. We're taking M-Razors there, all this stuff. The soldiers and a lot of the equipment goes straight there through a lot of different intricate line hauls. And I'm kind of managing that. That's like my bread and butter. My Super Bowl now is getting the stuff there, the logistics. And I'm like, man, I'm the logistics guy now. We arrive there. And the Marine Corps Mount Warfare Training Center is great training. They train all the individual Rangers up. And I'm kind of on the backside. The way their training is structured is they train at lower echelons all the way up to a final collective exercise, just like the Army is familiar with, JRTC, NTC, JMRC, where there's a force on force.
Okay.
The first half, though, at the Marine Corps Mount Warfare Center was a lot of individual training and small unit training. So it's a little bit lower threat, a little bit. You go out, you come back, you AR, you reflect in these short stints. And during that time, I'm doing all the logistics training, getting everything established. And we start to hear murmurs, hey, the companies that are forward, we might be gearing up for something big. There's intel that the Islamic State in this area, there's going to be a large presence during this time. And this is August 16th. And so we're like, okay, well, we're back here. So I guess the rest of the guys are going to have to fight that.
Yeah, good luck, guys. Yeah,
yeah, we're going to train. My battalion commander is tapped in. You know, he's on the command and staffs and stuff like that. He's on the updates. Everybody else is forward. We're like, okay, hey, sounds fun. We're going to be back here on the bench kind of thing. We initiate the force on force training. And I think it was three, four Marines. And the training is, hey, kudos to them. Marines were great. They're tough as nails that we were training with out there. But it was set up to be an unfair fight, as in all CTCs, but like, imagine Army CTCs and then put it on a 20-degree incline, because Bridgeport, California is right outside of Yosemite.
Okay.
And so there's these peaks. Like I said, it looks like Northeast Afghanistan. It looks like Nuristan.
Wow.
And, you know, they're just like, Rangers, go to this mountain, and then the Marines are going to fight up the mountain. And we're like, oh, man. good training for them. Hey, good defense for us. You know, whatever. We'll do that. And the cool thing is that, hey, I did all the logistics as a company XO. My company commander was like, okay, you're going to be a fighting XO out here. You're going to take elements, you know, two platoons. I'll take a platoon and some other assets. You take, you know, so I was a maneuvering XO. Mm. We were out in the box, essentially. I was maneuvering logistics with our M-Razors and our trucks, you know, maneuvering mortars and stuff like that. So I was like, hey, this is kind of cool. Hey, I'm only about a month or two into XO time, and I'm like, I'm a GFC XO. I'm a ground force. I'm maneuvering all these things. Not a PL anymore. My old platoon is still out there. You know, high-fiving them, but hey, that's another person's platoon right now. Helping other PLs, trying to coach them along. They're doing their thing. I'm like, okay, I'll be the XO. This is fun. This is great. I'm maneuvering as an XO. This is great. We go through the entire rotation and give some good training reps over to the Marines. And then we literally get back. We march back off this mountain, like through the day. So it's like a long mountainous road march, took a lot of hours, kind of the final thing, you know, get back to the area, like take off the rucksack, put it down, take a stretch. And, you know, the company commander is like, hey, I got to hop on the phone. I'm like, okay, got that, right? He comes back and he's like, hey, we're going. And I'm like, what do you mean we're going? Going where? Going home? Yeah, right? Good training, right? We're going to get pizza?
Right, right.
I think there's a pizza place around here. He said, no, we're going to Afghanistan.
They don't have good pizza there.
No. And so we're like, okay, what do you mean? You know, how are we going to do this? It was like morning hours. We had marched through the night. It was like 08.
Wow.
And, you know, in Afghanistan, it was like later in the day, obviously. They had piped in and they were like, yeah, there's a big operation and they need every company.
Mm.
And there's going to be a big operation that they need everybody. And so we're like, let's do this, right? What's the timeline? What are we doing? He's like, 72 hours we need to be in Afghanistan.
Wow.
and we're in Bridgeport, California, Afghanistan, 72 hours. We have a good chunk of our gear, but we are not fully mission capable with the gear that we have because we just packed to do this about month-long training exercise. So we're like, okay, we need to frog hop from California to Savannah, Georgia, to Afghanistan. How do we make this happen? Oh, by the way, I'm the company XO. This is a gigantic logistics operation. This is emergency deployment. It's going to require some crazy and creative and detailed logistics. And who's the logistician in the company? It's me. I start coordinating with the Ranger team in Savannah. We are just wheeling and dealing, figuring out what we're going to do. And we are like, the first thing is like, where are we going to fly out of here? How can we get to an airfield in like 12 hours? We start looking on like Google Maps. Where are the nearest Air National Guard bases? Where can we fly out? Because we flew in commercial, all the equipment line hauled. But that takes a long time.
Yes.
It takes days.
Yes.
We had 3 days and half of that should be en route to Afghanistan. So we're like, we can't do that. How do we get out of here fast via air? We start looking for Air National Guard bases. We call some, they don't work. Like, we're literally just like calling phone numbers on Google, trying to make this happen. And through the awesome Air NCO that was formerly my two of the guys up in the three shop were formerly my squad leaders in my platoon. Now they're up in the S3 shop in Range Regiment, starting T and starting N. They're coordinating, had a great relationship with them. Finally, I'm coordinating with them. Like I said, we're just wheeling and dealing. We're like throwing darts at a wall. Like, how are we going to make this happen? And this air team, they pulled together strategic C-17s. Like they reach out into the apparatus and say, you know, hey, we need this. You know, the entire SOCOM apparatus surges on us to make these air assets available. And we ended up figuring out that the Reno airport and the Reno Air National Guard base could only support C-130s. We were actually closer to San Francisco, but we couldn't use San Francisco because they couldn't support a C-17.
Okay.
And so we're like, okay, we're going to go out of Reno, but then their runway and their Air National Guard team, they could not support C-17s. They could only support C-130s. And we knew this. Part of the reason why we located it, we're on Google Earth looking at images and we just see C-130s. We're like, we need to get in contact with them. And they're like, but there's a part of the runway that can support that, but that's not by us. And so we're like, okay, how do we make this happen? And there's a private hangar there. It's just a company that does like it, and parked out front is like G5s, you know. And we're like, okay, this is wild. Let's figure this out. We make a quick phone call and they're like, yeah, we'll do whatever you need. And I'm like, okay, this is too good to be true. And I'm like, sir, like, I'm going to take a shower. I need to get in the van and go to the airport, like right now. I put some tasks in charge. Hey, the soldiers are coming off the ruck, you know, after this ruck back. And it's like, shower, eat, clean your weapon, and it's going in weapons rack. We're not taking our time. There's no AR. We actually skipped all the ARs.
Wow.
We skipped everything. The Marines were like, hey, tell us how we did. We're like, sorry. Things are going in the weapons rack. Rangers are walking by the Marines like, hey, we're actually going, you know. The Marines like, you're going where? Can't say. They're quick, you know, they're putting stuff together. Everything's going right. I get in a van. I get down to Reno and I'm just like, I'm driving around figuring out where this hangar is. I get there, pull in. It's this like super nice private hangar. There's like no labels or anything like that. I'm like, hey, I called, you know, what is this? And I start explaining it like what we're going to, hey, we need in 18 hours. I would like to land two C-17s here and I'm going to have 180 Rangers here. And I have all this equipment and I'd like to put it on C-17s. The receptionist is really nice. She's like, hold one moment. she like goes in the back. She's like, I'm going to have a conversation with the owner. She puts him on speakerphone and they're like, land it all again. I'm like, I just sound like, and they're like, okay, yes, we can make this happen.
Wow.
Tell them to land right here. Tell them to, they're like, we'll gas them up.
Oh, know? Wow.
And part of that, you know, they charge the gas or whatever. It's like, we need to go. And he's like, whatever you guys need, like, we'll make it happen. We'll move the G5s.
Amazing.
We'll move the G5s. And this place is like it's like the private terminal for like big gamblers in Reno. But like it's where, you know, all the private jets land, people to hang out. And this place is like lavish. I'm still in like grimy a uniform. And they're like, do you want any espresso? And I'm like, yeah.
Yes, good. Please.
Yeah. I'm with there with like two of my NCOs. They're like, oh, sir, can we have coffee too? And I'm like, yeah. You know, okay. Part of me is like pinching myself, like sleep deprived. I'm like, is this work? Am I just dreaming that I'm doing good logistics right now?
Right.
Like I'm going to wake up and I'm still going to be in my rucksack, you know, still going to be
on top of the mountain.
Yeah. Still going to be my sleeping bag next to my rucksack. He's like, you know, we're going to make this happen. And so we started coordinating a little bit more coordination with them, the times, the place where the C-17 is going to land, back to the air team, like, okay, we're going to make this happen. Then I started coordinating all the, you know, we're doing these emergency line hauls. So we're contracting out to private contractors to move. Private contractors move our connexes of weapons, of ammunition to an airport in hours time frame. And money solves a lot of problems,
right.
But it's still like a crazy rush to do this stuff. A lot of no's.
Yeah.
You know, we're calling FedEx, UPS, all these companies that do emergency logistics, all these private contractors. They have special logistics teams that do this. They have like GPS trackers on their trucks and they have like triple double cabs so they can drive overnight and make this stuff happen. Part of my team back at Bridgeport is coordinating this stuff and they're getting pallets on these trucks. By the time I get back, they're loading weapons on the back of these trucks.
Wow.
The vehicles are getting ready to line haul. So I see Humvees rolling up, our M-Razors rolling up on flatbeds. This is like 7 or 8 hours. All these things are falling into place. And we're part of my XO team or the headquarters team that I was running. You know, I have my supply NCOs. I have the headquarters NCOs. I have the admin clerks that are kind of all under me. My first sergeant's running it.
Sure.
Company commander's running it. Now they're going places. Okay. Hey, you need to ride with this team because they have the weapons. You need to ride. This team is leaving in 2 hours. They have the ammo. Okay. You need to, these trucks are leaving here. You need to stay back at Bridgeport because this package is coming late. We need to bus the soldiers.
Right.
Charter buses. We need charter buses now. The soldiers getting on. Probably within about 12 hours, we were ready and we got picked up like at 3 a.m. from Bridgeport. So this is about 24 hours has elapsed from the word because all that coordination was like tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
We will be at the airport and the soldiers are getting picked up. I'm riding ahead to make sure all the weapons and stuff are arriving. There's guards on them. All of our vehicles are starting to get downloaded. We arrive at the terminal and they have sack lunches for us all. And it's like, this
amazing.
Is, yeah, this is, they were gassing up the C-17s. There was no government charge card exchange with that. They were amazing. Giving us, like I said, Rangers coffee, Rangers sack lunches. We're just hanging out. They're all like, this is the best deployment we've ever had. You know, like, this is better than back in Savannah.
Right.
We don't get this kind of treatment. We're downloading stuff. And I remember the C-17 teams is like, hey, you know, I'm like, what hazardous statements do you need? I got all this stuff. Like, my binder's a mess. I'm like trying to figure this all out because I'm like, the serial numbers, like, I think they all match up. You know, I'm doing this in a scramble. And they're like, listen, this, we're on like emergency orders. We just need your word. What's in this box? This is ammo. Okay. It needs to go here. What's in this box? This is weapons. Okay. It goes here. Right. And they're like, we're ready to go. We're ready to make this happen. Like there's not a piece of paperwork that's going to stop this from happening. LT, do your best, but this stuff is getting on the plane.
Right.
I remember right at that moment, we're starting loading stuff up. Right at that moment, one of the two Humvees that we brought, and they're all stripped down Humvees and stuff like that, it just starts dumping coolant right on the runway as we're like loaded up on the C-17s. So the mechanic comes out and he's like, okay, like of all the things, I can't have coolant leaking all over the aircraft because it can mix with the fuel that's already in the aircraft and it could create a hazard. You know, if there's
okay.
So they're like, okay. Mechanic comes out. He's like, sir, I don't have any gaskets. I don't have any tools. My tools are in the connex. What's going to happen? And we're just like, I look at the Air Force team and I'm like, dump it.
Yeah.
Drop all the fuel. Drop all the fluids out of the vehicle. So we just like open up the oil because it was like all mixing together. All the fluids. It was like a triple leak, essentially. Even the windshield wiper fluid was, you know, and you know, we were like trying to, he's like, I don't have any tools, nothing. So it's like, okay, we're dumping all the fluid. Open up the oil pan, open up all the fuel. We're just dumping it right on the runway. And then we're going to use the C-17 winch to get it up there.
Wow.
And so we're like just pushing it up there. And at this was the time we were leaving in like an hour. And so the Rangers start loading up. They got their rucksacks and we're like, you know, we're against the clock the whole time, but we're like, we need to be in this aircraft. We need to bring this Humvee, like dump all the fluid out of the Humvee. We'll figure it out on the backside. I call the team back at Savannah. I'm like, I need another Humvee. I'm like, we're going to push off a Humvee off of this thing. And our connexes of gear are going to stay on the aircraft. But we need XYZ when we get there to be put back on the aircraft to make extra stuff that we needed, other equipment that we didn't bring, mountaineering kits, other weapons. Like, we only brought like a assortment of small arms. We're talking like our whole kit, all the, you know, the arms room loaded out and everything like that. So the rear D is working around the clock to package up, I think, two or three more Connex. And oh, by the way, a gigantic pallet of ammo. And so we don't have time to pick up ammo. We're like loading ammo in Savannah to be taken overseas too, because we don't know how fast we need to deploy.
Sure.
We get in, we take off. Like I said, the Humvee is bone dry. We put out some kitty litter on the runway and we tell the team there that was really nice to us. We're like, we're sorry. We have to go. Like, you guys have been great to us, but we have to go. And they're like, don't worry. We'll clean this up. We get back to Savannah. And the first sergeant and the commander was like, hey, how much time do we have? How do we figure this out? I'm like, okay, we need to be here. We need to be wheels up by this time. And it's like, can the soldiers go back home real quick? Do we have time to do that? It's a logistical question. Okay, our weapons are here. Our equipment's here. What other equipment do we need? What equipment? Some equipment needs to come down and be cleaned or fixed or adjusted or repackaged in order to go backwards plan all this time. How much time do we need? And we found out we had there was 6 hours. Commander and first sergeant were like, let's send this soldier home real quick.
What a bold leadership move to take that risk that somebody might not be able to come back or any number of issues, something might happen while they're gone and you don't have anybody there to fix it.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, I think that the team leaned on the rear D. It was really good that First Sergeant and the commander trusted my assessment, my planning, and my team and everybody that was working back at Savannah. They kind of trusted our whole analysis at the time. And they trusted that if we said, hey, the soldiers can go home for 6 hours and we'll still make mission, they trusted that when we said that was the time frame, we were going to do it.
Wow.
And so the soldiers went home and we got back. So it was nighttime in Savannah and we got back. So about 40 hours had elapsed from the word. And we were going to be back at 04 the next morning to do a fly overseas. I stayed, I don't know how many hours. I was able to go home for about an hour, you know, making sure all the logistics were straight. My team was working. The NCOs back in the battalion, they worked through that whole time, you know, because they were also again, my old squad leaders that were working the air and that whole thing, Sergeant T and Sergeant N were like, sir, go home. Say, my girlfriend was now my wife at this time, was living in Savannah now. And he's like, go home, give a hug, take a nap, take a shower, eat an egg sandwich and come back. We got it. And, you know, same thing, the trust there.
Yeah.
It's like Sergeant T, Sergeant N, they got me more than half the work they were making happen. I'm like, okay, you know, my butt's on the line. You guys say that we'll be wheels up. All the ammo will be here. All the other pallets will be here. All of our equipment will be ready on these C-17s. I trust you as well. And so we come back and all the ammo is getting packaged. Everything's getting loaded up and we are wheels up and everything is on time. We fly out to Afghanistan. We land. You know, the process of downloading is super fast. We don't have billeting. We arrive there because there's more Rangers on the ground than they've had in a long time. Because now it's a whole battalion on the ground plus some. Because they had brought in other assets in. And so everybody's gearing up for this large clearing operation. We kind of get the brief. Islamic State in Nangarhar, since we had left, had kind of created an even stronger hold in Nangarhar, in the Achin district specifically, which is like this elbow in Afghanistan, this last little chunk, almost like a California-shaped thing on the eastern side of Afghanistan, the borders Pakistan, right on the mountains. They had pretty much controlled that whole area, and they were doing a lot of operations in and out of Pakistan. They had controlled the area. They were facilitating a ton of attacks on Jalalabad airfield, which was in Nangarhar as well. And so Jalalabad had been taking the brunt of a lot of their terrorist attacks. And then at the same time, since they controlled that area, and they were doing a lot of illicit activities. A lot of the funds they were trafficking from their stronghold there to Iraq and Syria. And so this was like pretty much their HQ in Afghanistan was Achin District, Nangarhar. And so the plan was to do a large clearing operation with both SF units and us doing point raids and overwatching their clearing operation throughout this large valley that on one end was the mountains of the AFPAC border and this other large ridge line that filtered Achin District and all the city down below. Okay. And so we got briefed up super fast on what that was. Just in time to like download our stuff. Like, okay, hey, this is where you're sleeping out of. This is your company. We like our company headquarters. I was used to operating out of the Jock and like, which is like ritzy. This is like the, okay, my last deployment, I had like my own bunk bed and like everything's good. It's like, okay, now you're in these bee huts, four people to this room, cots, sleeping on the ground. You know, it's like, okay, we got to get ready. We got to go. And so our piece of the pie was to then take one of our platoons, as well as a mortar platoon, a lot of other assets, and establish kind of an entire overwatch position, a mortar firing point and a support by fire position at the top of this ridgeline that keyed into the valley to allow the clearing operation and a couple of raids to go on in the district. So we were going to establish kind of the isolation and contain of the broader mission. We were going to do other point raids along it while the SF teams and some of the Afghanistan Special Forces teams cleared in the valley. And so my company commander was like, okay, we're going to do these other raids. Bravo Company and Alpha Company are doing these raids. SF teams are clearing. He's like, Ryan, I want you to set up this overwatch position. You're going to lead one platoon. You're going to lead first platoon and the mortar team. And some of these other elements out there. So you're going to be a ground force commander. And I'm like, okay, you know, I've been in Afghanistan before. I've led formations in live fires, led formations when we were at Bridgeport as a ground force commander, which looked a lot like Nangarhar, but had never, you know, gone out and led a formation. And that was at a time when a lot of junior officers were not leading multiple formations by themselves. Typically, the raids that were occurring during that time in Ranger Regiment, there was always a company commander able to go out with the platoons, with strike forces, because there wasn't a billion raids going on. There was enough to where a company commander would go out with each element because there's only one a night or two a night. And so this was, you know, I was going to be the leader of this on the ground element, and we were going to be the first ones to go out.
Wow.
Yeah. So the coordination continued, and in about 48 hours, we started the planning process and the rehearsals. I think maybe one misconception that people have about special operations is like, hey, you got your guys, trust you, just take your guns out there and make it happen. It's like, no, we rehearsed, plan. We went through all these CARs. I'm briefing at these CARs, these rehearsals, these combined arms rehearsals, all the aviation, all of the fires, all of the intel. All of the signal support that is controlling this whole thing is going into it. And then I'm briefing and coordinating with the platoon and the mortar platoon that's below me because I'm going to be the GFC.
Right.
And also I'm having to coordinate with the SF teams that are doing the ground clearance because I'm going to be overwatching them. And then a huge tricky part of this was that we were going to overtake a position that was occupied by ANA police. And we were debating if we were going to let them know.
Right.
Are we going to tell the ANP, the Afghan National Police, that we're coming? Because we were going to be the first ones in to establish this overwatch, you know, set security, right, for the kind of the clearance. And the decision was made that we weren't going to. We're going to land there, and we're going to tell them, hey, we're taking over your police station type thing, which was up on this ridgeline overlooking the whole valley. And so all of this kind of coalesces, and we move out to Jalalabad. So we're at Bagram, go to JBAD with our entire package. The whole company moves out there because my company commander is planning to do other raids with the other platoons. And the company commander and first sergeant are like, okay, we're going to go on other raids. We don't know when we're going to go on them, but you're going to lead this mission. We're going to stay back with the other platoons. You're going to lead this platoon and the mortar platoon and the other elements and do this, you know, and trust
wow.
you. And one thing my sergeant major said earlier on in a conversation, I was talking to him, I was like, you know, I'm going to be kind of a company commander. And he was like, you know, don't worry. He's like, if you weren't capable of being a company commander, you wouldn't be an XL. You know, that's the whole point of it being the XL. So don't think that we're like, oh no, lieutenant or captain, fresh captain, you know, not career course qualified, fresh captain. Don't think that we're like, oh no, Captain Crane's going to be a GFC. We haven't had a junior officer be a GFC in a long time. I don't know if he's ready to lead a company size formation. It's like, you wouldn't be an XL if we didn't think you could do that.
What a great thing for him to say, especially at that point.
Yeah, and that was another Star Major, I'll just say Star Major A, because he's still in it. He's still in the USSOC community. Star Major A was awesome. It's like he was always one to kind of put his arm around junior officers as a Ranger Regiment Star Major.
Wow.
One of the key aspects that I've had is really awesome NCOs. NCOs that did not have to be great officer developers. And he was one of those. And he was like, you're ready to go. You can lead this company formation out here and you can do this. My company commander trusted me. Same thing with my first sergeant. My first sergeant and I had gotten really close. First sergeant P, and he's still in it too. He was awesome. And he was like, you know, you're ready. You can go out there. You did it in Bridgeport. My company commander, Lieutenant Colonel M, awesome. Now he's Lieutenant Colonel, but he was at the time just captain. Was awesome. He was like, you can go do this. And so it was about 80, I think it was 86 Rangers, two dog teams. Interpreter had, I think, 15 Afghan Special Forces teams. We had two M-Razors that had a mortar system attached to it, two JTACs. And we were loaded up on four CH-47s. So we were coming ready. So four 160th teams ready to move that entire package out to get ready for the clearing operation. We're getting ready. It's a night insertion, you know, hours before. And I'm just like, you know, we're out at the airfield checking comms, checking nod. At this point, like, the plan had been briefed. We're ready. It's kind of like you're getting ready to walk out on the field, essentially. And so there's nothing else I need to say. I know the PLs, the two PLs that are with me, they know to do their job. My counterpart, who is the headquarters platoon sergeant, was going to be like kind of my first sergeant counterpart. His name was Chris Solis. Just mentioned now, he's awesome. Love the guy. A year and a half later, he was killed, and he was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. Chris Solis, awesome dude. Loved him. And he was my NCO counterpart on the mission. Same thing. He was reinforcing, hey, we can do this. It's not a big deal. We'll just go out. I'll lead this element. You know, so everybody had been briefed. Everybody was ready to go. And so now it's just like kind of me internally, like, checking my own stuff, my weapon, you know, put my weapon into, you know, operation, make sure all my radios are good, make sure my RTO is squared away. And, you know, just seeing that the CH-47s, like rotors, like the rotor sparks in the night. And it's like, we got four CH-47s. We got 80 something Rangers ready to go out, and I'm in charge of this thing. I'm going to be the
amazing,
the ground force commander. Yeah. All these people around here, all this gigantic apparatus, and I'm in charge of this thing. This is like the first time. Imagine if you leave your last game as a high school quarterback, and all of a sudden you're in the Super Bowl. That's what it kind of felt like to me. Just tell myself, like, okay, we rehearsed, we planned, we're ready, everybody's fit. We know the mission. There's junior leaders below me. They know exactly what they're doing. They're more than capable to do without me. Senior leaders above me are like, you know, they're all smiles. They're like, you got it. Not a big deal. You do your part. We'll do everything. It's going to be good to go. And so, you know, we come in four CH-47s at night, land on this ridge line, and we land. It's essentially an XY landing, like pretty close to the ridge line where the police HQ is. It's about 150 yards away. So it's not like we're going to land and walk in and knock on the door. It's like they know there's four CH-47s moving at night, landing right on this ridgeline. And it's in a pretty densely populated area. This ridgeline that overlooked the valley, there's homes everywhere, but there's this area where four CH-47s land. And again, we had M-Razors too. So they're ramping off, you know, they're driving off.
Right.
And so we land. We cordon off the place. We get the interpreter up there. My one platoon goes up, and was like, you know, the plan is to tell them to leave. We're taking over. And I keenly remember this is a big mistake that I made, because that was a risky part of the operation. You know, they could potentially engage us, and they go up there, they make contact with them, and without gunfire or anything like that, like relieved, they tell them, hey, we're taking over. There's not really a, you know, there's not really a negotiation.
Right.
We're taking over. Right. You guys need to leave, which obviously creates some risk. Maybe they inform people later on. And I remember I came over the SATCOM, right? So I'm the only person on the ground, potentially the biggest operation going on maybe in the U.S. military at this time. And I came over the net, probably a whole bunch of people listening. And I was like, our interpreter team and my elements in engaging the Afghan National Police right now. And he was like, say again, engaging? And I meant like conversating.
Right,
with
right.
They're all this good. No factor. They're talking to them. They're going to move off. And so we're going to seize our position. And I was like, why did I say engaging? If there's any a double meaning of a word,
right.
You know, that was the worst.
And that situation. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that kind of shook the confidence a little bit. Right. And so we established this position in the hours of the night, arrayed over this hilltop. Morning comes. We start firing mortars on suspected enemy locations, and where there's sporadic small arms because the clearance operation starts that morning.
Okay.
And so there's Afghan special forces and Green Berets coming over around our left, starting the clearance operation, and they're clearing anywhere from 600 meters to 2 or 3 kilometers below us in the valley.
Okay.
At the longest point, but they started kind of over this ridgeline down into this city that we were at the top of the slope at, this ridgeline. So imagine kind of like a mountain town in Breckenridge or something like that. We're on this hilltop that started, and the city slopes down to this funnel, gets more densely populated. So that's where the clearance operation begins. And we start doing preparatory fires. We start firing mortars and we're registering. And I think it's one of the first times that mortar system had been used, because it was a 120 millimeter mortar on the back of an M-Razor.
Okay.
And so we're registering this mortar system. We have Rangers taking up firing positions and stuff like that. There's some sporadic small arms. We lower all the assets in the air. So like at this point in time, I'm still the GFC and my JTAC is controlling all the assets that we have. So we lowered all of the Reapers. We lowered all the MQ-9s to where you can see them. Like they weren't up at the higher elevations. We lowered them down. AC-130s in the air because they start clearing. They start taking contact. And they have that fight. We are following their clearance. We are firing mortars at other suspected enemy locations. They are in contact. And I remember we had to get a resupply. And so my first sergeant came in and he dropped off a whole bunch of batteries on a UH-60. And he was like, you good? You need to tag out? You know? Because he was expecting to go on other missions.
Right.
You know, my first sergeant, my commander, and they hadn't been tagged to go on any other raids or anything like that. And he was like, you good? You want to tag out? I was like, first, no, absolutely not. And he was like, what about Salih? He's like, you guys want to come back in? Me and the commander come out there? You know, you're good. And I was like, no, I am good. And he was like, okay, we'll probably come out tomorrow. If clearance operation is still going on, we'll probably come out tomorrow.
All right, fair enough.
I was like, okay. I'll probably fight you then about it. But anyway, the clearance operation is going on. I just kept kind of thinking about, like, you know, we were in California like 6 days ago.
Yeah, right.
And all the platoon that's out here is in, ready to go. They're working with the mortar team. They're working with, you know, we're picking up SIGINT and stuff like that. We're trying to figure out where small arms fire is coming from. We can tell that the ODA is in contact. It was like, we came all this way in less than a week's time. And now here we are. And it was just kind of put it all into perspective, like how much willpower and how much, like, the combination of you put competence and you put willpower and you put the nation's assets in a blender and you mix it up and you can create like a really awesome smoothie. And that was us out there that quickly.
How are your soldiers feeling right now? You have described, you had this whirlwind experience.
Yeah.
On the back end of all that training they were doing, which I imagine was pretty vigorous.
Yeah.
And now you're here in combat. What's the morale like? How are the soldiers doing?
Yeah. Uncharacteristically high. Rangers are a special breed. We're out there and we're not taking direct and accurate fire. And we're taking kind of a sporadic, inaccurate fire from our position. We can tell the ODA is in contact. We're firing mortars, but the 11 Bravo is not firing mortars. The Charlies are. Uh-huh. I got the JTAC with me. He was working. My SIG and teams are working, but the 11 Bravos are kind of just like keeping their head down. Like they're trying. They started putting up American flags because they wanted to get shot at.
Right.
So it's like these guys, you know, and that was like a motivating thing too. It's like, okay, we just did all this thing. And I reflect back on my element back in the 82nd. We came from JRTC and we were thinking about going to Syria. And I was like, everybody's motivated there too.
Right.
But everybody's tired. Everybody was like, let's go. And then the Rangers, same way, just crank it to 11. Like they started putting up, they brought flagpoles and American flags. A lot of guys carried American flags on their kit like that. But they had erected American flags to like signal, come up here.
Right.
And, you know, we had the high ground. Anyways, right. Like we were loaded for bear and maybe they knew that. They were putting up American flags and the Rangers were just, they were just awesome. And they worked kind of through the whole process. And a lot of it, we were firing mortars and we were directing aircraft. The 11 Bravos were so hungry to get in their fight. And they ended up only essentially getting shot at, but not shooting. And so, but it just kind of speaks to how a competent force put in the right position and enabled can just be so hungry for what combat is for them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then the clearing operation, it did end up resulting in a more complex ambush to end up killing an ODA member.
Mm.
It was an IED and that part of that ambush, and they were in contact and we were directing age 64s on their location, but they were so like, we couldn't direct fire support. I was with my JTAC and he was awesome. He knew he didn't need me, but we were pushing assets aside, getting the 64s down there and getting the medevac in there. And the Rangers are just ready, mortars ready. And that clearing operation, they completed the clearing operation. They got the ODA member out of there. And this was in October 2016. And so all those Rangers had gone through all of that and they all had occupied that position. Obviously, the Rangers that never got to fire or direct fire, they still enabled the clearing operation. They still enabled that mortar firing point to be set up.
Absolutely.
And we suppressed a lot of that valley. And then that operation ended, but Aachen District, Nangarhar, was still a hotbed for operations all the way leading up to that Moab bomb being dropped there only weeks later. So that was just one of many targeted operations in that area. That I think our operation was kind of one of the largest operations, in which we had to get everybody out there trying to stir up that bee's nest that was IS in Afghanistan and surging on that. And that clearing operation was a big part of that.
So this is a pretty incredible story of logistics, of leadership, of camaraderie, of preparation. What would you say are some of the big leadership lessons from your experience?
Well, an overarching point is that competent leaders who are trusted can do anything that they're enabled to do. Like I said, throughout this whole process, I was really supported personally by my leadership, by all the way up the battalion command teams, all the way down to my company command teams, the NCOs that were supporting me. And I think I put a lot of NCOs on the bubble too. Hey, Sergeant, you need to go out to this airport. You need to control our small arms. Here's the keys to a Dodge Ram. I'll see you in 6 hours. Hey, Air NCO, like I need X amount of rounds of ammunition. You need to make that happen. And it's just when you get the right people together, when you get the competence and the mutual trust, that's really where Mission Command can really flourish. It just was a testament to the idea that if you get the right people on the team, they can really do anything. I think another thing that I think about being, you know, the kind of the logistician turned GFC in this whole thing is that, you know, as an officer, you're just entrusted to solve problems. And I didn't think that I was going to be a chief logistician in a rapid deployment across, I get probably half the earth. I don't know. I've never tracked the total miles, but it's probably about 12,000, something like that. You're there. You're at the helm of all these problems as an officer, regardless of your MOS, regardless of what rank you are. Regardless of the job you're filling at the time. And so officers just need to kind of embrace their role, that if they lean on their soldiers and they lean on the supporting structure of the Army, they can solve the real toughest problem. Doesn't matter if you're, you know, this cherry captain.
Absolutely.
You know, that has never deployed, that has never put his boots on, you know, the ridge lines of Nangarhar. If you're in the right place, the right time, and you're entrusted and you can solve problems, then you're going to be put at those problems. Doesn't matter what other circumstances there are.
I think you framed it very well. You mentioned Mission Command. And while you were talking, I was thinking all the examples from Mission Command that you were giving. Leader's intent, I need you to take this truck to do this,
yeah.
Go.
Yeah.
And then you've got mission type orders that you just
yeah.
gave. Disciplined initiative, mutual trust, competence. I mean, prudent risk, yeah. all of it. Yeah. What great examples of Mission Command.
Yeah. We teach Mission Command in the Simon Center where I teach. Is one of the founding structures in our Army that enables it to do what it does. And it was just kind of a great example of how mutually supporting they all are. I would have not been trusted if I wasn't deemed competent.
Right.
If I wasn't competent enough, I wouldn't have been able to, from my company commander, said, Ryan, get in that truck and go figure out where we're landing, two C-17s, 24 hours. All of those things work in concert with each other, and they're all so dependent, interrelated on each other that you can't be lacking. You can't trust somebody who's not competent.
Right.
You can't just give them intent if they don't understand your orders.
Right.
You can't trust somebody who doesn't have the wherewithal to understand where their piece is in the puzzle. So they're all so supporting and they're also reinforcing each other. The more competent you are, the more you can trust somebody, which makes them more competent, which makes them be able to use intent better without giving explicit orders. So,
and you can assume a little more prudent risk, you know, and trust yeah. them to exercise better, even more disciplined initiative. Yeah,
absolutely.
For sure.
Yeah.
Well, let's close it up by talking a little bit about the Simon Center. You mentioned that earlier. It's where you are now.
Yeah. So I left the Ranger Regiment in early 2017. I ended up commanding in 1st Infantry Division. I come to command there, and part of the Ranger Regiment is Abrams Charter, one of the founding pieces of doctrine there. That's about the Ranger Regiment being formed so they can come together, like I said, competent individuals that trust each other, and then they go back out to the regular Army and try to help the regular Army get up to the standard that they were amongst. And so that's what I try to do. I try to impart what I had on 1ID. What's awesome, one of the greatest things about my command that I always say, like I said, when I was a lieutenant in the 82nd, two lieutenants from my brigade went to the Ranger Regiment. When I was a company commander in 1ID, I sent two of my lieutenants in my company. Of the four lieutenants in my company, two of them went to the Ranger Regiment.
Oh, that's great.
Two lieutenants in one company go into the Ranger Regiment. I continue to tell them I got this from the Ranger Regiment. I still talk to those guys, still love my LTs, Mike and Jeff. I left 1ID and I applied for and got accepted to teach at West Point. Part of that package is to go to grad school for 2 years. And I chose an MBA program at Michigan Ross School of Business. I really wanted, even though I didn't talk about Mission Command a ton or didn't understand it like I do now, I knew the Army has a way of solving problems. They have processes. They have the way they think. They have doctrine. They have troop leading procedures. That's the way the Army solves Army problems. I wanted to see how businesses solve mm-hmm. business problems. And I figured that, you know, a business education would be adjacent to problem solving processes in a different light. So maybe I could take some of that, bring it back to the Army.
Did you find that many of the practices in business and in the Army overlap when it comes to leadership?
Yeah, the Army has a chokehold on what leadership is.
Yeah.
In a good way. I think business is management, right? So you're managing processes. You are managing and leading people. It's part of business. There are amazing business leaders out there, but the Army is about leading people to do extraordinary things. And the outcomes of that are winning wars, are protecting American sovereignty, protecting the Constitution, whereas in business, you know, it's about nonprofits excelling at a venture or profitable companies earning returns.
Right.
That involves leadership, but the processes in which its businesses use are certainly more focused on what their product is and the ways in which they gain returns or ways to which they reach end states if they're a nonprofit. Whereas the Army just simply understands that, just like I said in the previous story, if you build the leader, if you build the soldier to be something extraordinary, it doesn't matter what's put in front of them. They can excel. If you build the lieutenant up to be something great, and then you get them this crazy logistics problem they have to go solve, and they have to go be a ground force commander in Afghanistan, if the person is the right person, if you develop that person, then they can handle that challenge. Whereas businesses are not built like that necessarily, because they build their own problems and then they solve those problems necessarily, right? That's simplifying it. But definitely I learned some of the ways in which they structure organizations and processes to solve problems, because businesses have a lot more control over those things. I learned some of those things, and it was a great experience to go there. To your degree there, and I came back to the Simon Center. And the Simon Center's charge, among many other things, with teaching MX-400, which is the capstone course on officership. Mm-hmm. So what it tries to do is it tries to coalesce all of the learning that cadets do here at West Point in their various courses, their majors, their core courses, bring them all together and put them in the context of what they're going to do. We are, in essence, at West Point, a vocational school. Everybody goes into the same profession here, at least starting out. And so whether they are a psychology major, a management major, a chemistry major, they take all these different courses. They take core courses, obviously, what they learned in English, what they learned in psychology, what they learned in law. And then we bring them together and we say, okay, you've learned all these things. Let's put them in the context of how you can apply these as an officer. Let's put into context, you know, what you are going to be up against, what challenges in the profession you're going to face, who you need to be, the identity that you need to embody to be an Army officer. Because it's not just, you know, hey, you're a soldier. Hey, right. You're a person leading. You know, hey, you're the CEO. An officer has an identity that they need to embody, founded and reinforced by the Constitution, enabled by our Army values and the virtues in our profession. And then finally, an officer has a responsibility. So what you are, your identity, the challenges that you're going to be faced with, just like the challenges I was faced with, who I was, and then what must you do against those challenges, given who you are? What is your responsibility as an officer? It's not just, again, in business, it's not just to get returns. It's not just to manage your soldiers, solve problem X, do task Y. There is a moral and ethical component to what we do. And again, why the Army has this primacy on leadership is because an officer has a responsibility to be able to address all these problems, and their identity enables them to be put in whatever situation it is, you know, whatever challenging, complex issue it is. If you're a lieutenant, you're a captain, what are you responsible to do? What must you do? There's not a book for all those problems. There definitely wasn't a book for the problem that I went through, but I knew what I was charged to do. I knew what I needed to do. I knew that I was enabled and trusted. I knew I was an Army officer. I had to make the mission happen. And so all of those things kind of coalesce into what we talk about and MX-400, what officership is as a profession.
Well, Ryan, I think that's a good place to lead it. This was a fantastic discussion and something that I've never heard of. I was in there for 27 years. I never heard of the type of mission that you described. I think there's a lot of great things that our audience will be able to learn from this. Before you go, just on behalf of Colonel Pat Sullivan, the director of the Modern War Institute, I'd like to present you with this rare and coveted MWI ammo can to take back with you across the compound SCPME. So awesome. Thank you so much, Ryan, for your time today.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate being here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.